you know, I try to get feedback between first and second services because it's really important. So I said to Cam, you know, how did I do? And he said, oh, you seemed really sick and tired. So there you go. So much to look forward to. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about as I was looking at this passage, and, you know, sometimes it just kind of coalesces with the things you've been looking at in your own life. But I've been thinking about identity. You know, and I wonder how much time do you spend in your life thinking about what gives you identity? And it tells you who you are and what your value is. You see, questions of identity are huge questions. They're huge personal questions. And they determine so much of your life. They determine what you think about yourself on any given day, and even what you're going to live for or how you're going to live your daily life. Now, I remember when I was growing up, have you guys ever been in this situation where, you know, you're a kid and then people say, what does your mom and dad do for work? Is anyone else ever in this position? Or is that only me? Because I feel like this happened all the time, okay? Yeah, you can interact with me. It's okay. Don't be scared. So this would happen to me from time to time. And you get into these things, and it feels to me like when I look back, it was like being in a circle, you know, and people start asking, oh, what does your dad do for work? You know, these things go around, you know, and people proudly say, well, my dad is this, and my mom is this. And they would stand tall and proud as they talked about it. But the truth is, for me, I always hated that question. Because at the end of the day, I had to say this, well, my parents are janitors. And I didn't know anything about the kingdom when I was a kid. I just knew that when you answer, my parents are janitors, people don't cheer you on or they're not as proud of you as if your parents are something else. And I just remember people staring at me awkwardly after I answered the question in this way. And it made me feel insignificant at the time. And oftentimes, it's even impacted me up until this day. Now, if you're in the janitorial field, just know that I do have the utmost respect for it. You know, as I grow and learn and begin to understand these things. But when you're a kid, it doesn't give you any clout. So it's a question of identity. And even something so silly and dumb as that can impact a guy like me as I grow up. You know, when I went to think about getting a bachelor's degree even, I was only one of the second person in my family to get a bachelor's degree. When I started working on my master's degree, no one in my family has a master's degree. And it was scary for me to think about going forward in this stuff. So questions of identity, they're hugely important. Even the smallest things start to affect your life. And in Jesus' day, questions of identity are no less important than they are today. Actually, this just reminded me of something, okay? Because it reminded me of this other thing that I did recently to find identity. And I wanted to share this with you because, as you know, we're talking about this bike trip that I'm going on. And I just love this bike trip. I think it's the coolest thing. When I was down and out, I found this to be so, so awesome. Because, like, I started working out with my buddy Cam, who works here. He plays the guitar and stuff, right? I started working out with my buddy Cam, trying to grow some self-confidence, self-significance and stuff. And, you know, it felt awesome. And Cam said, you know, we should do this bike trip thing. So I went on there with him. I was so excited to be part of it. And then one of the things that you realize when you start biking that you didn't realize at first is you got to wear these tiny spandex shorts, okay? Now, I wasn't all geared up to do that, okay? When I worked out when I was younger, I just worked out my upper body, never worked out my legs. You know what they say, never miss leg day. But Cam, on the other hand, has these huge hulking legs, okay? So we get out there. And then I come out in my tiny stick legs. I always say I look like a lollipop, you know, like big on the top. And then black doesn't, it makes you look slimmer too, right? And then Cam's massive rippling legs are out there. So I start the ride and he says, oh, you just stay with me, you know, like we're about the same speed. And I'm thinking, okay. So we're riding together, you know, it's okay. And we're keeping up. And at first, even Andrew Neufeld was with us in this, which made me feel super fast because Andrew looks like a stealth bomber. when he's out there. And we were talking with him and everything, and then I'm thinking, you know, I'm really keeping up with these guys. And then he says, okay, see you later, and then poof, just takes off. And I realized he was just trying to talk to me. I wasn't actually keeping up, right? So me and Cam are left behind. And, you know, I'm keeping up with him, and I still felt good. I just, you know, I just looked at his legs and followed them. And then, you know, as I built up my value and significance, thinking I'm equal with him. You know, it's okay. Then what he does is he takes his shirt off right in the middle of this thing, and then it was like vehicles just started, you know, swerving as they're going past him, trying to look at his body. And it does not make you feel more significant, okay? You know, if you have scrawny legs and you're looking for somebody to ride with this year, you just ride with me, okay? We'll be okay together. Anyway, you can see here, questions of identity, they're important questions. And they're no less important in Jesus' day. In fact, even things like having scrawny legs, you know, it's silly. But these things can impact the center of your life. So today we look at Luke chapter 14. You can turn it in your Bible or we'll have some on the screen. Luke chapter 14, verses 25 to 35. And I think what's going on here is Jesus is going to tell his shocking thoughts on what identifies the people who follow after him. So we'll put it up on the screen here, and I'll read it off the screen. It'll just be easier to do. Here we go. A large crowd is following Jesus. He turned around and said to them, "If you want to be my disciple, you must hate everyone else by comparison, your father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even your own life. Otherwise, you can't be my disciple. And if you do not carry your own cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. But don't begin until you count the cost, for who would begin the construction of a building without first calculating the cost to see if there's enough money to finish it? Otherwise, you might complete only the foundation before running out of money, and then everyone would laugh at you. They would say, 'Hey, there's the person who started that building and couldn't afford to finish it.' Or what king would go to war against another king without first sitting down to discuss with his counselors whether his army of 10,000 could defeat the 20,000 soldiers marching against him? And if he can't, he will send a delegation to discuss terms of peace while the enemy is still far away. So you cannot become my disciple without giving up everything you own. Salt is good for seasoning, but if it loses its flavor, how do you make it salty again? Flavorless salt is good, neither for the soil nor for the manure pile. It's just thrown away. Everyone with ears to hear should listen and understand." See, in this passage, Jesus is addressing the things that his audience used to formulate their very identity. I think you could narrow it down to this: family, self, and possessions. But Jesus challenged these things as the source of identity, and instead declared that if you were to follow him, your identity would have to become this. It would have to become the cross. This was the essence of Jesus' call to discipleship. Now, an important reminder is that discipleship in Jesus' world was common. And if you don't know much about discipleship, basically what it comes down to is the closest thing today is like apprenticeship. However, you didn't sit in a classroom. Discipleship in Jesus' day meant literally following your teacher and watching and participating with them. And essentially, it makes the whole world your classroom. Okay, everywhere you go, everything that you do. Now, this teacher that you'd follow would also be known, or more well-known, as a rabbi. And if you had a rabbi and you were the student, you would form super close bond with that person. You'd talk about the most important parts of your life. It was actually thought that the closeness to your rabbi was an essential part of the learning process. So one rabbi saying goes like this: as one candle lights another only if it is brought close, so a rabbi only teaches well when he is close to his students. In fact, it actually wasn't uncommon in Jesus' day for a rabbi to take on a role similar to that of being in your own family. And sometimes becoming even more important than your own family. So there were some other sayings like this. Another rabbinic saying is, your father brought you into this world, but your rabbi brings you into the life of the world to come. Or it's also said that were your father and your rabbi to both be taken captive, as a disciple, you should ransom your rabbi first. Now, the point of these rabbinic sayings is that the rabbi-student relationship required complete and utter devotion. And as you can see here in this passage, it's pretty clear that Jesus' call, it's no different than that. So Jesus says that crazy thing about, unless you hate your family and your life and give up everything you have, you can't follow him to where he's going. You know, when you see the word hate there, I don't know if you're like me, but it sounds terrifying. Okay, I think, oh, hold on a second, Jesus. I thought you loved people and families. This doesn't sound very good. But it's important to know that it's a rabbinic way, okay, a rabbi way of calling people to utter devotion. Now, you need to know that Middle Eastern people don't talk like we talk here, okay? We have more of a rationalistic culture, whereas theirs much more focused on bringing the emotions into life. Okay, so for example, I remember when I was in Bible college, my buddy Greg, he was an older guy, he had traveled a lot in his life and stuff, and he said to me, he's like, yeah, this one time I was in Egypt, and he was traveling with a tour guide who was an Egyptian guy, and they were looking for a bathroom. Okay, so they said, I need to go to the bathroom. Tour guide goes over to another guy, and he starts talking to him. And next thing you know, things are getting crazy, kind of heated, and it just blows up into this big, intense thing where it seems like there's finger pointing, and you know, it's just so wild and intense. And my friend, this is what he said to me, I kid you not. He said, well, what happened there? What on earth did you ask him? He said, I just asked him, where's the bathroom? Okay? So obviously they must have talked a little bit about their lives, but the point is, they are really passionate, okay? They're really into saying stuff. So Jesus is using a common way to get his message across. This is serious stuff, okay? Common rabbinic stuff. Now, it's important to know, like, the reason why I'm saying this is because you don't want to get off on the right track here in case this is new to you and then go about trying to hate your family. Because that would be to entirely miss the point, okay? Because we know as you read on in the Bible that Christians are called to love their family in the most extreme ways, okay? So Jesus is not saying treat your family poorly. Everyone got that? Okay. I don't want to hear about you guys doing that afterwards, okay? Okay, so Jesus is making this call of saying you need to radically reorient your life. You need to radically reorient your values. You need to radically reorient your identity. And to take the things that we would normally use to decide who we are or what we're going to do and who we're going to be, and to take those things and entirely reshape them, to reshape everything, everything. Absolutely everything, right down to even who we are as a person and how we think about ourselves, and to make that shape into the shape of the cross. That's kind of an artistic way of thinking or whatever, okay? But this is what I'm saying. It's shaping your life after the cross. So a call for total devotion to a rabbi, that wasn't totally scandalous, okay? It's scandalous, but it's not totally scandalous. But a call to reshape your entire identity around the cross? To my knowledge and everything I've read, no other rabbi even said anything close to that. So what on earth could Jesus possibly be talking about? Well, one of the most important things that you can do, in my opinion, is when you're as you're listening and as you're going through the book of Luke, you want to hear about or think about what are the themes that Luke's drawing out, right? What are the kinds of things that Jesus is hitting on? What are the kinds of things that he's talking about? And to bring them from one sermon to the next, okay? Not just whatever the point of the sermon that I'm saying is, but what is Jesus focusing in on? What are the key things? Because he's going to keep bringing this stuff up. And if you've been following that, you'll notice that Jesus has been really messing up everybody's categories. Okay, he's said these crazy things. He said this thing about how the first would become last and the last would become first. He's shaking stuff up. He said that the humble will be exalted and the exalted will become humbled. He's shaking stuff up. In short, you know, you could sum this up where he's lifting up the idea of the least. He's saying this is an important category, to be the least. This is an important category, to be the last. And in this next chapter, which we can't get to today, but he's going to say this is an important category, to be the lost. He's challenging insiders and outsiders in his world, and he's turning their whole social conventions on their head. Okay, he's flipping the whole world upside down. And today what he's doing is he's not just saying society needs to be reoriented. Society needs to be changed. We need to change the way we're thinking. Now he's saying you need to think about you. Okay, not what's going on in that person's life, not what's going on in society over there, but what you need to do is you need to think about you, and the challenge is personal. You see, another theme that's been going on in Luke, some of this is from far back, is Jesus has been letting his disciples know. He's saying, I'm going to go to the cross, okay? I'm going to go, and I'm going to die. And Luke even says they don't have any clue what the heck he's talking about, okay? Nobody's grasping what he's saying. And you can kind of see that as you continue to go through Luke, that even after what he's going to say today, people still don't know what on earth he's talking about. Now, one of the most common things to talk when you're talking to people about the cross is they say, isn't the cross like a metaphor? You know, it's like it's a metaphor for life, right? Isn't this what it is? I suspect that that's probably what Jesus' disciples were thinking, right? They're thinking, this is an interesting metaphor. We're going to go through something difficult and come out the other side, right? Surely this must be the kind of thing he's talking about. But what he actually meant is that it was really going to happen. It actually, it's one of those times where someone says something crazy and then they just meant it to be as crazy as it sounds. Okay, he was really going to go to the cross. He was really going to go and die, but it never fit into anyone's worldview. Okay, who would do this kind of thing? Who would go in this direction? So he was going to be shamed. He was going to be humiliated. He was going to be tortured. And he was going to die. You see, this is really kind of the plain Jane simple reality. Oh, I'm spitting like crazy. I need one of those masks, you know, because I'm sick too. So my apologies, John Marie. You're probably going to be sick after this. Okay. You see, as Christian people, we believe that Jesus of Nazareth is God incarnate, okay? So God come in the flesh. And it's God coming to his own people, who are the people of Israel. These are God's very own people, what he considers his own kids. And he's saying to his own people, he's saying, you need to reorient your lives. And he's been especially challenging to those people that should know better, okay? People in high religious positions, those who are leaders, those who hold authority over other people's lives. And he's saying to them, there's something going on here. It's messed up. You need to radically shift your priorities. And he said to them, he says, listen, you need to quit with all your busyness of trying to become important and take seats of honors and getting higher levels of status and looking down on each other. And as Alan said last week, it was this picture of this banquet where God's inviting his own people. They're the number one people on the guest list, right? They're the people supposed to be in for the party. It's just, boom, oh, am I inviting John? Of course I'm inviting John. He's one of my best friends, you know? And then none of those people show up. Because they're important people. They got better things to be doing, okay? And then that master says, okay, let's just invite basically, you know, some ordinary people. Let's invite those people. And then the servant says, there's still more room. And then he says, just invite everybody, anybody. It does not matter who it is. You just let them in. We need to fill this room. And those people that had all sorts of places to be and people to see and important things happen in their life, they missed the kingdom. And Jesus is saying this not to be snide or not to look down on other people. He's saying it for this simple reason, okay? This is what he really wants to get across, is because Jesus is saying that because these are people he cares about, and he simply wants this. He's like, I want you to follow me. Okay? That's what he's saying. I want you to follow me. Just as students follow their rabbi, literally walking behind them. Okay, there was like this rabbinic saying that says, may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi. And that's not a metaphor either, because the person's kicking up dust behind them and stuff. This is why I'm glad I don't have to literally follow Alan everywhere, because he walks vigorously, so. Lots of dust kicked up. Okay, he wants these people to follow him in life, not as an idea, not as a metaphor, but to literally go where he's going. And so Jesus is warning people. He's saying, listen, there's this crazy difficult thing about following me, is it's that if you're going to follow me, you got to go where I'm going. And so he warns people, you need to understand. You need to understand. If you're going to follow me, you need to go where I'm going. And so each of us have to really ask ourselves this question, okay? Because we get the first part. We say this, listen, I ask you, are you a follower of Jesus? And people, yeah, I'm a follower of Jesus. Okay? Well, that's an all right question. Here's a better question. Are you going to follow Jesus where Jesus is going? Okay? Otherwise, you can make up any Jesus you want and go wherever you want. Am I really following Jesus where Jesus is going? Now, I want to make a small aside on this, okay? Because this is something that I think needs to be pointed out. My friend Bobby, I'm going to talk about him here. He's totally fine with it, okay? I've asked him. But this is the thing. Sometimes I get this. I'm in my young adults group, right? And Bobby, this guy's like my own son. I love Bobby. He's so great. He was with me in management. He was an employee of mine. It was such a great time together. He's awesome. And then, he doesn't come to the young adult stuff that we're doing anymore. Which is fine, right? It's not all about me. It's all good. I ask him, Bobby, why don't you come anymore? Then he says, oh, I just don't really fit in with the people there. They're kind of nerdy. Okay? And I said to him, I said, Bobby, I'm like, listen, you're a follower of Jesus, right? Yeah, I follow Jesus. I said, okay, you start at A. The Z of discipleship is to love your enemies, right? Yeah. I'm like, well, you're not even at B, which is to hang out with someone who's nerdy, And I said, you can't recreate Jesus and think, oh, yeah, you love your enemies, that's all right. It's, are you going to follow him to where he is going? So sometimes, we get in this call to discipleship stuff, and people often say to me, hey, man, if you're going to become a follower of Christ, one of the first things you need to do, one of the first things you need to think about is, are you willing to pay the cost? So it's like second day of Bible camp. Okay, today, this is the are you going to pay the cost day of Bible camp. And we think we made that choice forever ago, right? Like, you've been in church 40 years. You've been in church 20 years. Oh, I decided that way back when. But this portion of the gospel, this portion of discipleship, isn't the beginning portion. Okay, you're in chapter 14 by now. This isn't the first thing that Jesus said. It's not even close to the first thing that Jesus said. It's more like closer to one of the last things that Jesus says. And I think that's really striking, okay? Because it tells me that even if we've been going with him for a long time, we still need to ask ourselves, are we ready to go where he is going? Okay? Or have we come up with a new Jesus, or we don't need to go there anymore? You see, to be a disciple of Jesus is to literally follow him. And the crazy thing about the real Jesus, okay, not the Jesus that we want, but the Jesus that we have, is that there's only one place where he goes. And he always goes there. And that place is the cross. Now, do you have the picture at the back there for my little PowerPoint picture? You can throw that up there, my friend. Thank you very much. And we'll just leave that up there. So this is a picture that I try and put it on all my stuff. I put on background screensavers and all this kind of stuff. And the reason why I do that is because it's my favorite picture of Jesus. Okay? And the reason why that is because this is actually the first depiction of Jesus historically. The first depiction of Duff, say, give me an amen there, okay? Historically, first picture of Jesus ever created. They think this other thing could be close, but this is probably the first picture of Jesus ever created. It was carved into a plaster wall in Rome. And the writing, you see writing there, right? And what that writing says, it says, Alexomenos worships his God. And as you can see, there's two characters in this artistic representation. There's Alexomenos, who looks like a Jewish guy over on the left. And then there's Jesus of Nazareth, who's the guy on the cross. And there's a couple things that really stand out about Jesus in this picture. Is number one, he has the head of a donkey. Number two, he's naked, and you can see that. And he's exposed completely as he's hanging on a cross. Now, if we were in less socially polite circles, you might say, I might say some crude things about this picture, you know, to get across to you what this artist is saying, okay? It's not saying something nice. What this is it's a picture of humiliation. The artist's point is clear. He's saying to this guy, Alexomenos, okay, he's saying to a worshiper, a follower of Christ, he's saying, this is your God, Alexomenos. Your God is a downright fool. He is a nobody. He's a nothing. He's a disgrace in the eyes of everyone. And everybody understands that. Hey, that's who you're dealing with. You see, this to me captures the point of what Jesus is saying. He's saying, again, that if you want to be a Christian, if you want to be a Christ follower, there's something you need to understand, okay? And I'm going to drive it deeper here because our world is not like the ancient world, so we don't always, you know, grasp the same things because the world's changed so much. But understand this, okay? In the ancient world, gods did not associate with our material world, okay? They don't like this stuff. These gods were perfect, unchanging, and untouched by the filth of our world, by the brokenness, by the death, by the decay. And this is why there was the idea that our souls needed to actually be freed up, unshackled from this physical body so it could rise up to the gods. Right? Get out of there and rise up. Because these gods would never, never, never come down to us. Because you got to understand, to do so would make that God less. It would be a going down. Okay? These gods would never come down to us because it would equal a humiliation. Now, as Christians, as I say, we believe that Jesus of Nazareth is God embodied. There's the scandal. There's the beginning of the scandal right there. Okay, no God would do such a thing, but one God did. He became a human being. He became flesh, growing from a boy, growing up, changing, weak and vulnerable, dependent on others' love. He became real flesh and blood, flesh. Then the crazy, scandalous thing is not that this God became just a human being. He didn't just become any human being. Nothing ordinary would do. He became less. He became a servant in the way that he lived his life. He was a master who sat his servants down to serve them. He was a rabbi who made himself less than a slave by untying the sandals of his servants and washing their feet. He is the one who humbles himself. He would actually disgrace himself for us. And that wasn't enough either. That wasn't enough for him. All his life he knew where he was going, and he had his sights set. You see, having gone low, having become a servant, he actually went lower than that, and he went all the way to the bottom, and he took up the cross, an instrument of death. But more than that, as Les said, it's an instrument of humiliation, a tool used by the Romans to make sure that someone became nothing, to tear away every possible shred of dignity that person might hold on to tear away every possible shred of humanity that that person might hold on to make somebody a nobody, a nothing, literal refuse, garbage in the eyes of the world. And that's exactly what the world saw. That's exactly what this guy was depicting to this man, Alexamenos, to say, do you understand? How do you understand the God you worship? He's an embarrassment to the whole world. And when you're thinking in Luke, you think, no wonder Jesus has such a heart for those who are last. No wonder he has such compassion for those the world deem the least. No wonder he longs to find and reach out and bring in and comfort those who are said to be lost. Because that is who he knew he would become. Someone left to die naked and alone. You see, maybe you've been in the Christian life for a while, or maybe you're new to it. And there's a lot of things that go around and get said. And it starts to confuse you, thinking that, you know, maybe the cross is a metaphor. Maybe God didn't go to the cross. Maybe that isn't the shape of his discipleship. But I want to tell you what this passage says to us is that being a Christian is not about following a mighty God of health, wealth, position, privilege, and power and prestige. It's about following this God, the God who would become human, the God who would become less than human, the God who goes all the way to the cross. You might have heard this before, but I don't think it's been written any better than this. My buddy Mark Strom, he came in and talked, and this is the, to me, the best thing he ever wrote. He says this: what does it mean to me that God is the kind of God who could be Jesus? He says, this God could put on eyebrows and kneecaps, tear ducts and saliva glands. This God could be born under the tyrants Augustus and Herod. This God could accept the smells of shepherds and the extravagancies of political emissaries. This God could start life a vulnerable, hunted child born into scandal. This God could grow up under foreign domination and amongst terrorists and outcasts. This God could sit in the street just playing marbles. This God could wear with pride the calloused, splintered hands of an honest workman building the houses and fixing the furniture of half-castes, outcasts, and bigots. This God could ask his cousin to baptize him along with the rest of the crowd. This God could make the best Pinot Noir or Cabernet Sauvignon even when the guests were too drunk to know the difference. This God could befriend a bloke in a tree with small man syndrome. This God could enjoy a prostitute washing his feet, giving her his full and undivided attention, and ignoring all that eye-rolling of lawyers and theologians. This God could spend a whole night making a whip to crack over the backs of con artists who rip off the poor. This God, he could wrap the greatest truths in the simplest stories and put a sting in the tail of every yarn. This God could take his own story and give it the most surprising ending. This God could let himself hang on a tree nails tearing at his sinews, blood, feces, and urine running down his legs. This God could invite women to be the first to know that he was back. This God could delay his own glorious homecoming long enough for a bite of breakfast on the beach and a yarn with an old mate to let him know there was no hard feelings and to pass on his mantle. This God is worth knowing. This God could reach into the crevices of mine or your soul to bring to life the longings that we smother so pathetically and recklessly with shame and excuses. This God could raise us up to life with him. This God could give us every blessing he can give himself. This God could draw out our petty self-interest without a hint of tut-tut, a frown, or a patronizing smile. This God could be more infuriating and fascinating and gobsmacking than any God I or you could ever make up. This God could love my obsessiveness and overlook my forgetfulness. This God could laugh and cry with me and come play with me. This God could make me and you his glory. This God could love you. This God can make your heart good. This God can trust us. This God can never be safe but always be good. This God is worth knowing. This is the God I want to know. This God I know in the face and spirit of Jesus. I'll pass the applause on to Mark. He said it was he got the most feedback, best thing he ever wrote. At the end of the day, I want to ask you, okay, it doesn't matter to me if this is your first day in the Christian life or if this is the second to last. We need to ask ourselves, Jesus is challenging us, okay, not some other person. He's talking to you because he speaks to us heart to heart. Then he's asking you, listen, what do you cling to find your identity? What do you cling to make you who you are? What do you use to shape, to give shape to the way that you live your life at work, at home, anywhere else? I just want to ask you just to sit and really let God, you know, just speak with you heart to heart. I thought about saying some different things. You know, it could cost this, it could cost that, it could cost this in your life. But the fact is, Jesus speaks to us personally. He says to a rich guy, give up everything you own. He doesn't say anything to Zacchaeus. He just says, go for lunch with me, right? There's all these different ways that Jesus speaks to you and me personally because he's asking us. He's asking us, if you were to follow me to the next step, what would it cost you? What would you have to give up? The Apostle Paul thought a lot about this. And one of my favorite things that he says, it's simple, but it's profound. He just says this. He answered, what the cross means to me is this. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Let's stop there for a second, okay? Because if you can't think of anything else, I want to tell you. If you want to try and do something hard in your Christian life, just try that, okay? Go to work and just for a week, don't try to promote yourself. Just try to promote everybody else. That's what he's saying. Don't do a single thing. Do nothing, 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 not a single thing. Don't do a single thing out of selfish ambition, not to raise yourself up. Just try that for a week, right? I don't know if you're like me, but there's lots of times when I was at work and I'm saying behind somebody's back, that guy sucks, you know, I should be promoted. Paul says, no, no, no. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, simply value others above yourself. Not looking out for your interests, but each of you to the interests of others. It's profound. We need to understand that the God that we follow is the God of the cross. And at the end of the day, the only thing to say is, do I follow him? Is, will I take up my cross? pardon me. Because Christians take up the cross. They carry it everywhere. Everywhere they go. Jesus says, you know what? It's simple. It's like salt that has lost its saltiness doing anything else. And I talked to several people about that, and they said, that just doesn't make any sense. Salt can't lose its saltiness. And I said, that's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. To live, to say you follow Jesus, and to live any other way, it makes no sense. It will only and always be the cross. Let's pray. God, I want to ask you because you're so tender and kind. And you're not a God who's putting on a big show or trying to reach high and mighty places. I mean, you're the God who's trying to get into our hearts and just to live right down in there. And God, we don't believe that you're some distant God or some dead God or some angry God, but you're the God of the cross. And that means that today, right now, in the simplest of our lives, no matter who we are, whether we think we're worth it or not, that you just throw out all of that stuff and you say, I want to live in you. I want to live with you. And God, what that means today is that we can speak heart to heart with you. That we can really ask you and open up our hands and just say, God, what is there that you need to take away? What is there that I need to hold loosely in my life? Is there something getting in the way where I followed you only this far? And I've said, I won't go any farther unless something changes. God, I want to pray that this wouldn't just be an idea, you know, a neat thing that we put in our minds, but that you would radically reorient our lives around the cross. What will our families look like? What will our workplaces look like? What will the way we see ourselves look like when it all wraps around the cross? God, thank you. Thank you that you would love and care for people as tiny as us. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
Man, can we